Hi, I'm Carla. We welcome you to the Gratitude Roundup Open Speaker Meeting of Al-Anon Alateen Family Group and hope you will find in this fellowship the help and friendship we have been privileged to enjoy. We who live or have lived with the problem of alcoholism understand, as perhaps few others can. We too were lonely and frustrated, but in Al-Anon Alateen we discovered that no situation is really hopeless and that it is possible for us to find contentment and even happiness whether the alcoholic is still drinking or not. We urge you to try our program. It has helped many of us find solutions that lead to serenity. So much depends on our own attitudes. As we learn to place our problem in its true perspective, we find it loses its power to dominate our thoughts and our lives. The family situation is bound to improve as we apply the Al-Anon ideas. Without such spiritual help, living with an alcoholic is too much for most of us. Our thinking becomes distorted, and by trying to force solutions, we become irritable and unreasonable without knowing it. The Al-Anon program is based on the 12 steps adapted from Alcoholics Anonymous. We try, little by little, one day at a time, to apply to our lives along with our slogans and the Serenity Prayer. The loving interchange of help among members and daily readings of Al-Anon material and literature thus make us ready to receive the priceless gift of serenity. Anonymity is an important principle of the Al-Anon program. Everything that is said here in the group meeting and member to member must be held in confidence. Only in this way can we feel free to say what is in our minds and hearts. For this is how we help one another in Al-Anon.
So last night we were talking when I got here, and we asked one another how long we were in the program, and she came in 6 years before I did. So I was sliding into hell as she was getting out of it. So I'm glad to see you here, and here's Sue.
Hi, I'm Sue. I'm a very grateful member of the Al-Anon Family Groups because today I love an alcoholic. And first of all, I want to thank James and the committee for inviting Keith and I to come and spend this neat weekend with y'all. And I want to thank you for the hats with the little goodies in our room. And I want to thank our home group, people from our home group, for coming with us. And my home group is the Gotawana Tuesday night Al-Anon meeting in Fullerton, California. Would you all please stand up? Stand up, please. Yeah. If you didn't notice, we got one guy, too. We have to say, I love the girls and Pete. And Pete stays in my home group because there's a lot of strength there, and he likes it. And he does have a male Al-Anon sponsor in a men's stag. People have asked me, do you sponsor him too? No, Keith and I had enough problems in that area before we got here. And we don't do that today. So I want to say one thing, though, for the committee. There's one job on the committee that's very important that gets very little recognition, and that's the treasurer. But that person has to be everywhere with a checkbook and keep the books straight and all that kind of stuff. And I was talking to her before this meeting, and she's a really neat lady, and she was going, God, you guys brought a lot of good-looking men from California. I said, they're all married. They have their wives with them. She said, well, ask any of them if they want to fool around this weekend. So all you guys from California, go give Helen a hug before you leave, because she's feeling unwanted, unloved, and alone. She's a neat lady. So that's funny. He's my entertainment. He always has been. I love him very much. And we was up here for the sponsorship thing a while ago, and they were announcing the closed-circuit TV in the rooms. He said, I think I'm going to talk from my room tonight. Nothing. And I want to say to all of you that are in your rooms watching this on closed circuit TV this afternoon, resting, having meaningful conversations, or an afternooner, thank you for letting me be a part of your weekend experience. I love recovery. I love having fun in recovery. And our group got here on Wednesday night, and we went down and took over a club in on Bourbon Street. And to let you know how little we've changed, he said to me, there was this live band in this club and nobody was sitting in there. And he said to me, Sue, go in there and tell them you got about 40 friends that want to come in here, but they don't drink. I said, okay. So I went in there and I asked the band, how soon are you going to start playing? And they said, in 5 minutes. And I said, I have 40 friends standing out on the street that want to come in here. And they don't drink. And they said, they drink Coca-Cola? And I said, they sure do. And they said, bring them in. So I went out on the street and I told Keith, I said, okay, it's fine. He goes, boy, babe, you still work. And we were the only people in there. And I couldn't believe that we were having fun and that nobody was buying booze. And they fed us and everything. And we had a great time in there. And one of the neat things about people in our home group coming with us this weekend is there's some of them that have never been out of California. And to watch people have a first in their life is a very neat experience. And I'm grateful that they trust Keith and I enough to want to do things with us from time to time. And we do not lead them to hell. Now, just like we checked that place out in the very beginning. And we were able to dance and enjoy a live band. Nobody can do that alone. Nobody can do that alone. And that's why the first word and the first step is we. We went to an AA meeting. We Skyped a newcomer, and she's here today. We infected her. We ran the CAs out of their meeting room and had an Al-Anon meeting there instead. And they let us, and we were really grateful for that. Then the guys got to go and have their AA meeting in the regular hall. There is no place where we go where AA and Al-Anon is not. That's our life. We fit things, our life, into the program. We do not fit the program into our life. And that's why we have such a good life today. It's because we are nothing without you. And with you and God on each hand, we get to enjoy life on life's terms. And we have a lot of fun together. And I got an email the other day from this gal, and this is so Al-Anon. And it talked about this man and the donkey and a little boy. And they were going to town, and the man was riding on the donkey. And they passed some people, and these people said, oh, goodness, look at that older man making that little boy walk beside that donkey. So the man and the little boy decided, well, maybe the little boy should ride on the donkey. So they go on down the road, and they pass these people, and these people said, oh, my goodness, look at that little boy making that older man walk. So they thought, well, maybe we're both supposed to ride. So they both get on the donkey, and they go down the road, and they go by some people, and these people said, oh, my goodness, that fine donkey, look at the load they're making him carry. And so they talked about it, and they thought, well, maybe we should carry the donkey. And so they both took a hold of the donkey, and they had to cross this little bridge. And they start across the bridge, and they lose their grip on the donkey, and the donkey just falls 100 feet down to the river. The moral of that story is, if you try to please everybody all the time, you're going to lose your ass. And that is so Al-Anon. This lady went into a store one day, and she was looking around in there, and she saw this little fuzzy thing sitting on the counter, and she asked the guy, what is that? And he said, that's a burger. She goes, I want it. And he said, no, lady, you don't want it, because it doesn't do anything a woman says. It only follows direction from a man. And she goes, what are you talking about? He said, well, whatever you tell it to do, it'll do, you know. And it's very destructive. She goes, I want it. And he said, no, give it direction. Tell it to do something. So she goes, burger carpet, and it just sits there. And the man says, see? And he says, burger carpet, and it jumps down and goes, and it just disintegrates the carpet right there. She goes, I want it. He said, no, you don't understand. Try it again. And so she goes, okay, burger, grapes. And it just sits there. And the man says, burger, grapes. And it jumps up on the grapes and goes, and it just disintegrates the grapes. And he said, see, doesn't do anything the woman tells it to do. You don't want this. And she said, yes, I do. He said, why would you want something that doesn't pay any attention to what women say? She said, well, you don't understand. My husband's a drunk. He doesn't believe anything I say. And I'm going to take that home, and I'm going to put it on the coffee table, and he's going to go, what is that? And she said, I'm going to say it's a burger, and he's going to say, burger my ass. I came in here with a lot of revenge in my heart and a very hateful and angry lady, and I don't ever want to live like that again. I enjoyed one of the speakers last night talked about the oil fields, working on the oil wells out in the Gulf, and I understood a lot of what he was saying because I came from a home, my dad worked in the oil fields for years. And we'd live in 3 or 4 different towns during one school year, and I went to 5, 6, 7 schools in one school year, and we followed the oil wells all around Oklahoma and Texas Panhandle and Western Kansas, and that's called oil field trash a lot. There was something inside of me at times that started to believe those kind of things that I was told. I never felt like I belonged anywhere. And finally when I was in junior high, my folks settled down in a little town in the Texas Panhandle, and I settled down there, and I started going to school there, and shortly after that, my father passed away with cancer, and my older sister had gotten married and started her own family by then, and that left my mother and my younger brother and I at home. And after a period of time, my mom started dating, and I hated her for that because it was, I felt like she's been very disloyal to my father. And I started rebelling, and I started looking for love in all the wrong places, and I ended up in San Antonio, Texas, in an unwed mother's home. And I stayed there for a period of time, and I had a child, and I gave it up for adoption, and today I'm grateful that I did that. Because no way at that age was I ready, willing, or able to be responsible and be a parent. And I heard something in there from a counselor that I never heard again until I found you people. And she said, God uses people to help other people. And God used you as an instrument to help some people have a child that they couldn't have. And I accepted that and I went back home. And the kids that I'd run around with before were boring. I didn't like them. And one night my mom said that she was going to a honky-tonk with her friends and that I want to go. And I said, okay. And so we went to that honky-tonk and I went in there. And it was smoky, it was rowdy, it was loud, people were fighting, they were drinking, they were dancing, and it's like, yes, I loved everything about it. And I went out in the middle of the room, and everywhere he went, something was happening. And I thought it took a lot of courage to do what he was doing, because he was starting fights. And he started the fight, and he came running past me, and said, honey, let me know when the fight's over, and he ran in the woman's restroom to hide. And I stood there like a good potential Al-Anon. I'd been given instructions, and I stood on duty. And when the fight was over, I opened the door, and I said, okay, cowboy, you can come out now. And he came out, and he asked me for the last dance. Now, usually the last dance was a slow dance where you rub up against each other and get ready to go home. And this was a fast dance. And it kept getting faster and faster and faster, and we never missed a lick. And as I look back on that, what I understand today is he got me downtown in the fast lane right now, and I love it. The next day he called me and asked me out. My mother said, no, you're not going with him. He's older than you. He's been married before, and he's in trouble all the time. And I said, I don't care. And he came to pick me up that night, and we go outside, and I said, my dates usually pick me up in a car. You don't have a car. He said, I know, I've totaled my car and my driver's license been taken away from me forever. And I said, no problem. And I got him in my car and I knew exactly what to do. Take him to the drive-in movie and you kiss and smooch and steam up the windows. And we sat at that drive-in movie and we watched the movie. And I remember thinking, this must be what it's like to be with a more mature man. And then I looked over and Keith had a six-pack of beer sitting between his legs. He was more interested in than me. And that set up that obsession that night, wanted to be number one in that man's life no matter what. And Keith and I started dating. And he came over during the week and watched TV with me, and then we'd have dates on the weekends. And my girlfriends were saying that their boyfriends would come over and dote on them during the week and watch TV with them. My boyfriend was coming over and falling asleep, I thought. You see, I did not understand pass out. And he was falling asleep on me. And that was unacceptable to me because it's like, who does he think this is? He can't ignore me and treat me like that. And at that time, Keith had really long hair and a long beard, and I hated long hair. And he came over one night, and he went to sleep on me, and it was the last time he ever did that to me, because I took a razor and I shaved half his head and half his face off. He got up and he went home, and the next night he came back and he looked the same. And he went around like that for 2 weeks. And we'd go drag Main Street, and we'd go this way, and then he'd turn around, he'd go this way, and I'd just giggle and laugh, and he'd say, everybody in this town thinks I'm two-faced anyway. And I'd just laugh. I thought he was so cute. And then we'd have an argument, and he wouldn't do what I wanted him to do, and I'd jerk the keys out of the car and throw them out in the vacant lot. And he'd get real angry. He'd have to go look for the keys, and he'd get mad when he came back in the car, and he'd get in the car and start yelling at me, and I'd start kicking and slapping, and he'd hit me, and he'd take me home, and I'd walk in the door, and my mother would say to me, my gosh, what do you do to that man to make him treat you that way? And I'd say, what did I do to him? Look what he just did to me, and I'd have a black eye. Never taking responsibility for my own actions. It was him. If he wouldn't act like that, I wouldn't have to do those kind of things. And we dated for 2 years, and Keith and his parents and I decided what he needed to do was go back to school. And he'd been to many colleges and never got a degree, but it was because he went to different colleges, and I knew that if he stayed put, he could get a degree, and I knew that I had what it took to make him stay put. So we moved to Stillwater, Oklahoma, and Keith enrolled in college one more time. And shortly after we got there, I had our little girl, Simone. And I remember when May handed me that little girl thinking, thank God she's a girl. Because Keith was a drunk and his dad was a drunk and his granddad was a town drunk. You see, I did not understand that alcoholism has no prejudice. It doesn't care what sex, color, race, or creed you are. It takes you to the gates of insanity and hell, and you don't even have to drink booze to get there. And we stayed there, and there was many nights Keith would come in and he'd say, and shortly after that I started working and Keith was going to school. And he'd say, I can't handle this. My folks are paying for school and you're working. And he says, it's too humiliating for me. I need to go out and just have 2 beers. And I said, but you always get in trouble when you do that. And he said, I won't this time, I promise. And I'd be sitting at home and pretty soon the doorbell would ring and there'd be Keith and the cop. And they'd say, if you'll keep him here this time, we won't arrest him. It was like it felt like people were always giving him back to me. It was my responsibility to take care of him, and I took that responsibility very seriously. It almost made me crazy. Well, it did. And he went to school there. We used to go out this place called The Hill. And it was a cowboy place, and one of those honky-tonks. And the old guys would line up over here, and the cowboys would line up over here, and they always had a fight out there. And I'd tell him, don't fight tonight, that's dumb. And he'd say, okay, I won't. And I'd give him the big lecture about not fighting that night. And so we'd be out there dancing, and I'd tell him, I gotta go to the restroom. And you sit right here. Don't move, don't get up, don't get in the fight. And he'd say, okay. And I went in the women's restroom, and I came out, and sure enough, there was a big fight in the middle of the dance floor. And I'm thinking, darn him, he does not mind me. And I push my way through all of these guys, and I'm getting in the middle, and pretty soon some guy socks me in the face, and I'm landing on the floor. People are saying, where did she come from? And I get up, and I'm socking guys back, and I look over in the booth, and he's still sitting over there. Like alcoholics never do what you think they're going to do. And we lived there for 4 years so he could get a 2-year degree. Typical alcoholic. And I took all the credit. Because by that time, alcoholism was telling me that I was nobody, that I was stupid, and that I didn't count. And the alcoholism in me started believing the alcoholism in him. And he came home one day and he said, "Babe, I want to go to California." And I said, "No, I'm not moving to California. It's too wild and crazy out there. I will never raise children in California." And he said, "Honey, you don't understand." He said, "You've been going to all these honky tonks and you've been drinking out of a paper sack and you get in fights all the time." He said, "What you need to do is move to California because you can walk in restaurants out there and they will serve you a cocktail. And you don't have to act like that in California." And I'm going, "Yeah." And so he hurries up and he builds this big box and sprays it bright blue. We put it on wheels and we hook it on the back of our station wagon. And we're headed for California. We have to stop at in Oklahoma City to get a prescription filled in a baggie at midnight. But you see, I denied that part of the disease because the arrogance in me said I'll be married to a drunk, but I will never be married to a junkie. I didn't know that a drug is a drug. And I lived in that denial. Now, it's supposed to take 3 days to get to California. It took us 30. Because it depended on what he took or how much he drank as to how far we went. And there was days that we just stayed put. And I remember looking at him and thinking that I had to tell Simone how to act. Or I had to know how to feel. Because if Daddy's in a bad mood, watch out. And we did that for 30 days. Our dog, we had a German Shepherd dog and a cat in the back of the station wagon with Simone, and we had all that laid down and towing that trailer. We looked like the grapes of wrath going out there. And our dog got so sick in that car. He would stand behind the driver's seat and wait for big trucks and chase them to the back of the car barking. And he'd bump into the back window and he'd be on the cat and they'd have a dog and cat fight and then Simone, they'd be on top of Simone and she'd start crying. I'd turn around, start whacking and bitching and Keith would start drinking them. We did that one day at a time for 30 days. And we finally get to California and it's going to be different. And he takes off and he starts working. He was not going to work in the oil fields again. He took a job for Chevron Research and he started working in the oil fields and being gone. And I remember standing at the windows waiting for him to come home. Or I'd be backing in and I'd start in there rehearsing. When he gets home, he's going to say this and I'm going to say that. And I'm backing in and I'm saying all this stuff. A little 4 or 5 year old girl would walk up to me and say, "Mommy, who are you talking to?" And I'd push her out of the way and I'd say, "Leave me alone, I'm busy." And because you see, he was my obsession and she was interfering with it. I believe that I thought about Keith's drinking just as much as Keith thought about his drinking. The obsession. And I heard a deal the other day about this person telling a nun that they were in love. And she said, "It's only love if there's two recipients. But if there's only one, it's an obsession." You see, I did not know that my husband had a love affair with alcohol. I did not know and I did not understand the first drink got him drunk. I did not understand any of that at all. I had to come to Al-Anon to learn all of that. Because I never could understand why I couldn't quit drinking. I couldn't understand that when we went to a restaurant and we ordered one cocktail, that he couldn't just have one cocktail. And I remember the first night he invited us out to dinner and we was going to go out and we was going to have that cocktail served us and I was going to be a lady. And oh my gosh, I was so excited. And we go out and to the restaurant and it's a nice restaurant. It's a brick building. It has the cocktails on a neon sign in the front. It was in a concert building with Shangri-La carved in a board over the door. It was in a place with roses painted on the window. It was a nice place. And I'm a lady and we're going in there because I'm going to be a lady no matter what. And we go in, they seat us and they ask us if we wanted a cocktail and we ordered a Shirley Temple for Simone. We did not leave her out at all. And they set those drinks down in front of us and he picked his up and he said, "Let's toast to the good life, babe." And I said, you bet. And we sat there and we toasted to the good life, and it was wonderful. And then he started ordering 10 to my one. I knew exactly how many drinks he had. And I watched these people around the room, and they were drinking out of these long-stem crystal glasses and swishing this stuff and smelling it, and I didn't know what in the heck they were doing that for, but I wanted to be a lady, and I wanted to do that. Because growing up in a trailer house and being oil field trash, you don't have fine china and crystal and that kind of stuff. And if I just have that, I'll be somebody. Because, you see, I was always comparing my insides to your outsides. If I could just feel the way you looked, I'd be okay. And so the waiter came over to take our order, and he asked us if we'd like to have wine with our dinner. And I said, you bet. And he came over and he set those glasses down in front of us, and I'm going, oh my gosh. And he poured Keith just a little bit and asked him if it was okay. I'm going, is it okay? What are you talking about? He drank stuff in Oklahoma, had things floating in it, pour mine. And he poured mine, and I sit there in all of my smug and arrogance, and I swish my glass and I sniffed it, and I was wonderful. I was a lady. Until I look across the table at Keith, and he's drinking out of the craft. And I just yell at him, what are you doing? And he yells back at me, I'm drinking. What do you think I'm doing? And Simone slides under the table, and she goes, not here. And I see the waiter standing over there. I go, come here. And I start yelling at him, come here right now. And he came over to our table, and I don't ever want to forget it. He looked right at me. And he said, I'm sorry, but you're not eating here. And I said, and why not? He said, because you don't know how to act. We're being escorted out of that restaurant, and I'm thinking, you don't understand. You don't understand. If you wouldn't act like that way, I wouldn't have to do these things. It's his fault. It's his fault, because he's drinking. We can never go back there because Keith's talking to everybody in sign language. And we get home and I get right in his face. Don't you ever treat us like that again. And he'd say, Sue, get out of my face. And I'd take one step closer and I'd be shaking that finger and yelling at his face. And he'd say, Sue, if you don't get out of my face, I'm going to hit you. And I'd take one step closer and he'd hit me, and the knockdown, drag out fight was on. Because I'll show you. And we had those fights all the time. Keith being from Texas, being a cowboy, he always carried a gun, and I hated that gun. It shot things you didn't want it to shoot, and it went off when you didn't want it to go off. And I thought, I'll show you. And I picked up a butcher knife, and I started fighting back with that butcher knife. And we stood toe-to-toe many times with that gun and that knife. He'd put his gun right on the end of my nose. He'd say, if you don't shut up, I'm going to shoot you. And I'd say, I'd put my knife in his stomach, and I'd say, you go first. He goes, what do you mean I go first? If I shoot you, you're dead. And I said, I know, but when the bullet hits me, it'll knock me backwards. The momentum will make the knife go forward, so go for it. We'll both die at the same time. And he'd look at me and he'd go, you're crazy. And I was. We had a fight one night. He came in and I wanted to fight with him, and he was tired. He'd been out there doing stuff. And he was tired, and he didn't want to have anything to do with me, and I started fighting with him. And he went in the bedroom and almost made a fatal mistake. He passed out on his stomach 2 hours into 10 minutes into a two-hour conversation. Now, when I'm talking to you, you don't ignore me. And I got my butcher knife, and I'm saying, damn you. Damn you. And I take that butcher knife, and I just start stabbing him all over his back, saying, God, please help. I didn't know I was asking God to do away with the insanity. And it's like all of a sudden I come to myself and I'm going, oh my gosh, what am I doing? This is the man I'm supposed to love and I'm trying to kill him. And I lay down and I cry myself to sleep. Next morning Keith wakes up and he goes, oh my God, what's wrong with my back? Something's wrong with it. And I go, I don't know, let me see. And he turned around and I peeled up his t-shirt and I said, you've been drinking all that rock gut whiskey. You've broken out with acne of the back. But just a minute, honey. I'll go get the rubbing alcohol and I'll fix it. And I loved every ooh and all he made. It was wonderful. pre-Al-Anon revenge. I just wanted him to hurt the way I hurt. You see, I didn't understand that alcoholics drank because they hurt. I didn't understand that alcoholics couldn't deal with reality and that's the way they drank. Why? I had nothing to soothe over those feelings. I just went deep in with more insanity. And one night, you know, we'd have those fights and I'd call the cops or Keith would call, someone would call the cops or the neighbors would call the cops and they were at our house all the time. And they'd take him in and I'd have to go down to jail and write a hot check and get him out. Now, nobody ever told me to do that. But I did. Because they had my obsession. And I had to get him out because I had to know where he was and what he was doing. And the nights that he was in jail was the only time I could sleep. You see, I slept for 15 years with that butcher knife under my pillow or stuck in between the mattresses, and Keith slept with a loaded 45 on his nightstand with the safety off. Those weapons weren't for people outside of that house because you never knew when one of us was going to go off. And we had a fight one night, and Keith went out, and he didn't come back home, and that wasn't his pattern. And I just laid in bed, and I started praying, God, please let him die out there. I thought that was a prayer. God, just let him get killed out there. Don't let him hurt anybody else, but kill him. And then I start crying, my gosh, what's happened to me? What is wrong with me? And I cry myself to sleep. And I get up the next morning, and he's still not at home. And it's like, darn him, I'm going to get even with him. I'm going to show him. And I went in and I got Simone up, and I said, come on, we're going to go find your dad. Now, I didn't have a clue where I was going to find him out there in California. It was like looking for a needle in a haystack. And so I got Simone in the car, and I thought, okay, I'm going to go down to this club that we used to go to after hours down in Orange, which is about 12 miles, 14 miles from our house. And I thought, I'll start out there and I'll go from there. And so we went down there and we got about two blocks from that place. And I looked over and here was Keith's pickup parked over by this house. And this house had a bunch of bikes on the lawn. By then Keith had become a biker and I was the most fearful of that image. And I thought, darn him, he's in there and he's drinking and he's using with them. And I'll show him. And I took the keys of the pickup out of my purse. And I drove his pickup two blocks from that house. And then I walked back to my car and I drove my car two blocks in front of that pickup. And then I walked back to pick up and I drove that pickup two blocks in front of my car. It took me 4.5 hours to get both of those vehicles home, but I did it and I felt good. And I wasn't a bad mother either. I did not leave Simone unattended in either one of those vehicles. She had to walk every step of the way with me. And we get home, and I'm feeling so good, I fixed him. And Chief calls, and he goes, honey, come and get me. And on my smug and arrogance, I go, no, you let one of your buddies bring you home. He goes, buddies, what are you talking about? And I said, you're over in that house, those Hells Angels drinking and using, you just let one of them bring you home. He said, house, I don't know what house you're talking about. I'm in jail. I go, jail? What did you do to get in jail by yourself? You cannot go to jail unless Simone or I or the neighbors put you in jail. You cannot go out there and go to jail all by yourself. And I just started ragging on him about that. And he finally said, Sue, whatever. Just come and get me. So Simone and I go down there and I pay the bail with a hot check one more time. And Simone said, let's get Daddy. And I said, no, we're not going to get your daddy. We weren't going to get your daddy this morning. We're not going to get him tonight. And all the way home, she was crying. She goes, I love Daddy. And I say, no, you don't. Your daddy's a rotten, no good son of a gun. He doesn't love you, and he doesn't love me, or he wouldn't act this way. You see, I took alcoholism so personal. I thought if he just loved us enough, he could quit. I am so grateful today because of this program that I understand that an alcoholic has the phenomenon of craving. That man did not want any of those drinks. Every time he promised he'd never do that again, I know today he meant it every time he made that promise. But alcoholism didn't. And it wasn't the man, it was the disease that had control of the man. And so we sit at home for a couple hours and the doorbell rings and I go to the door and there's Keith and he did the dumbest thing, he always did it. He introduced himself to me as if I didn't know him. I'd go, "What do you want?" He'd say, "This is Keith Yarm, I live here, you know." And I'd go, "Not anymore." He'd say, "Sue, please let me in." I'd say, "If you want in, you beg. You beg." And he'd get down on his knees in front of his own home to beg to get back in, robbing that man of his dignity. And when I thought he had enough, I said, "Okay, you can come in now." And he went back in the driveway and he said, "Oh, by the way, babe, thanks for bringing my pickup home. I wanted to die. I hadn't done that to be nice." And this disease is a progressive disease and a lot of ugly things happened in our home. We got in a big fight one night and I fell down on the floor and got the whole side of my face kicked in. And I was always going to divorce Keith. And the next day I went to work and I made up all kinds of lies of what happened to me. They were so good I started believing in myself. Because if I admit out loud what was going on in my own home, I'd have to do something about it. And I had no answer. So denial was the easier, softer way. And so at noon I went across the hall in that building to a lawyer, and I'd been there before. And he looked at me and he said, "My gosh, Sue, what happened to you?" And I said, "Keith and I got in a fight." And he said, "Do you fight this way all the time?" And I said, "No, only when he drinks." He said, "Do you think he's an alcoholic?" And I said, "I don't know what that is." And he said, "It's somebody that can't stop drinking." And I said, "Then he must be one. Because I've poured out booze, I've filled bottles up with water. He got drunk on water a lot. I bust those bottles because I wanted him to know that I knew. I'm not stupid, you don't understand." And that lawyer looked at me and he said, "If you love him," the magic words, "if you love him, why don't you take him to Alcoholics Anonymous?" And I said, "What is that?" And he said, "That's a place where people go to stop drinking." And I said, "Great. Thank you very much." Walked out of there, I had an answer, I didn't need nothing else. I finally got an answer. And I went home from work that night and Keith was laying on the couch and I said, "I went to an attorney today and I told him that I was going to leave you. And he told me if I loved you, I'd take you to this place called Alcoholics Anonymous." And Keith looked at me in all his sincerity and he said, "Babe, I thought I'd come to this." And I called a man in AA today and he told me there's a meeting tonight just right down the street. And I said, "Good, we'll go." He said, "We'll see." You see, I wanted to believe he loved us enough. I didn't know he'd been to court that day and was on a court card. And I'd asked him, "What time does that meeting start?" He said, 8:30. So I hurried up and I fixed dinner. Because you're going to take them to a place like that, you got to cook for them. Because I hadn't cooked in a long time because our food ended up on the ceiling and walls and everywhere. And I hurried up and I cooked that night and Simone and I did the dishes and I kept watching the clock. And at 8 o'clock I went and got my butcher knife and I walked over to the couch and I jabbed him and I said, "Get up." He said, "What for?" I said, "We're going to go to that Alcoholics Anonymous meeting." He said, "I don't think I'm going to go." And I jabbed him again and I said, "I think you are." And he went out and he got in the car with me and he told me where to go. And we get over in front of that church and there's an AA sign there in front of the door. And I said, "What time is this meeting over?" And he said, 10. I said, "I'm going to tell you something, dude. You come out of that door before 10 o'clock, I'll gut you." Now, when I got to Al-Anon, he told me I couldn't keep a drunk sober, but I just did. For 4 months, sitting in front of that AA door at that church with my butcher knife. And I kept him sober for 4 months, taking him there every Monday night, sitting in the car with my butcher knife. When I thought he had it down pat, I let him go by himself. And he got struck drunk immediately. Because you see what I understand today, that an alcoholic can't sober up for anybody but themselves. That every alcoholic has to hit a bottom. And I also believe that every pre-Al-Anon has to hit a bottom. I do not think that an Al-Anon is somebody that's married to a drunk or married to a sober alcoholic. When I got to this program and got a sponsor, my sponsor said that was normal before I got to this program, I was normal. But a real Al-Anon is somebody that hits the bottom and makes a surrender and goes to the program of Al-Anon. You go to meetings, you read the Al-Anon literature, and you get a sponsor. And then you start giving this thing away. That's what an Al-Anon is. But I wasn't one then. And for the next 4 years, the drinking progressed in my home, the insanity progressed in me. Many times Keith and I would have those fights, and he'd be done, and he'd walk away from me, and that rage would be inside of me, and I don't know what to do with it. And I'd turn around, and Simone's standing there, and I'd start beating her head against the wall. Because you see, I'm insane. And I don't know what to do. And I gotta hurt everybody around me because I'm hurting. And I want you to hurt like I hurt. I did not know it was a disease. And we think only the alcoholic hurts our children. I remember one time someone said, "Mommy, I know why you're doing this. You're trying to show Daddy that you can act just like him." And I thought, how does she know? And I had to get to the point that I had to get to. And I don't ever want to forget that last drunk in our home. And I remember standing there and looking at Keith, and he had Simone over in the corner doing all the things to her that I used to do to her. It's like I had that moment of clarity. And I know that this is when God moved into my life. Because I didn't grab my butcher knife and I didn't yell and cuss and scream and holler. And I looked at Keith and a calmness came over me. And I said, "I don't love you anymore, but I don't hate you either." And if you got to be a skid row bum, because that's what I thought happened to drunks, then that's what you got to do, but we ain't going any further with you. And Simone and I got a few things together, and we walked out of that house for the very last time, and I am so grateful. I've gone for about 4 days, and I don't remember those 4 days, but I remember walking in a corner and crying in a little 13-year-old girl pat me on the shoulder saying, "Mommy, it's going to be okay." And she talked me into taking her back home to get some things for school. She needed for school, and I finally said, "Okay." And we went to that house, and we were afraid of what we was going to find because Keith was always going to commit suicide or shooting animals or whatever. And we didn't know if he'd be dead or what would be dead in that house. And so we walked back in that house and we looked around. And we finally found him face down on the bedroom floor. And we kicked him. And he turned over because we thought he was dead. And he turned over and he looked at me and he said, "Sue, please help." And this is when God came into my life for sure. Because he gave me the power to say one word I could never say to that man. The most powerful word that we could ever say to those of you that we love that drink too much. "No. No, I can't help you. If you want help, you help yourself." That had to be God. I could never say that. And thank God he got up off of that floor and he made some phone calls for himself. And we had to fight with the gun and the knife one more time because that's who we are. And the doorbell rang and I went to the door and little Jack Callahan standing there, little gray-headed fruit. And little Jack walked in our house and he did the classic 12-step call that it talks about in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. He asked me to go with him to take Keith to a detox. And I did, and Keith checked himself in and little Jack took me back home. And he said, "You need a program called Al-Anon." I said, "No, you don't understand." He said, "Yes, I do." First time anybody had ever said that to me. "Yes, I do understand." And he said, "There's a program called Al-Anon that will help you because you have the disease of alcoholism. There's been nothing positive come out of your mouth all night long and you need help." He said, "Let's go in the house and let's talk to Simone. So she's worried about her daddy." And he went in there and he said, "If you love your daddy, the only way you can help him is go to a program called Alateen." And so Simone and I started going to one meeting a week while he's in that detox. It's like I was numb and I was just going through the actions. And then when they got ready to let Keith out of there, they called us in as a family for a meeting, and this counselor sat there. And she said, "You're going to Al-Anon, that's good, you need Al-Anon." And I shot straight up, hands on the hips, and said, "No, I don't. If he will stop drinking, I will be fine." I said, "I have worked, I have paid the bills, I have this, I've raised the amount, I have done everything." And she said, "Then if you're so good, why do you find it necessary to stand here and yell at me like this?" First time anybody had ever made me look at me. And I started crying and I sat down. She looked at Simone. She said, "Simone, how do you feel about your father?" And Simone, 13 years old, she said, "I hate his guts." And I said, "Good. I'm glad you're hearing that sober. I've tried to tell you that many times." And then she looked at Simone, and this counselor said, "How do you feel about your mother?" And she said, "I hate her guts." And I knew at that moment I needed recovery just as much as anybody. I needed help. And I went back to Al-Anon for me. And I remember walking in that Al-Anon room, and at that time the cover in the Al-Anon big book said, "Living with an Alcoholic," and it's like it had a neon sign on it. And I knew it was home. And I felt good. And I started going to that meeting, and I asked a lady immediately. After about 2 weeks, I only went about 2 weeks. And this lady was leading the meeting. She had 18 years in the program. She was an older lady. And I thought that she'd been there for a lifetime. 18 years was a long time to hang in with anything. And she was very sweet. She answered all my questions before I asked. And I asked her to be my sponsor. And then she got real mean with me, like I shared in the sponsorship meeting. She didn't listen to any of my stuff. I was a trash mouth when I got here. And she used to call me smart mouth. She never told me not to talk like that. She'd say, "Okay, smart mouth." And I'd ask her, "What do I do about this?" And she'd say, "What do you want to do?" And I'd tell her, and she'd say, "You do exactly the opposite." And she didn't listen to any of my stuff. And one day Keith was gone to a Sunday afternoon AA meeting, and I'd gone down the hall in the linen closet, and it was one of those sliding door things. I mean, all the walls in our house had holes in them, all the doors were off the hinges, you know, windows were broken and closet doors didn't work. And I tried to push that door back to get something out of the linen closet, and it got hung up, and I got so angry, and all that rage came back 6 weeks into this program. And I jerked that door off the hinges, and I just threw it down in the hall. And I thought, "Oh my God, what have I just done? I'm an Al-Anon." And I went immediately to the phone. I called my sponsor, and she goes, "What are you doing before you went down that hall?" And I said, "I was fixing dinner." And I said, "When Keith comes home and he goes, 'What's for dinner?' I'm going to go, 'What's for closet doors?'" And she goes, "No, you're not. You're going to go back in there, and you're going to finish dinner, and you're going to stay out of that hall." And I said, she said, "Turn it over and let God take care of it." And I'd say, "Okay, God. Keith will be home in about 20 minutes. You better work fast." And Keith came home, and I'd gotten in for turning it over. I didn't know what turning it over was. I did not understand that, so I would play forget. And my sponsor said, "That's good enough." And Keith came home, and he started walking down the hall, and he said, "Oh, my gosh, what happened?" And I went, "Oh, my gosh." And I started saying the serenity prayer, "If you're going to kick in, you better do it now." Because that kind of thing would have started a huge fight in our house. And I heard myself say, the door came off and I couldn't fix it, and I put it on the floor, and I'll fix it later. He said, "No problem. How long will it be before dinner's ready?" And I said, "About 5-10 minutes. And he goes, "I'll fix it myself." I thought, oh my gosh, this program works. Unreal. I could not believe it. I went to those meetings. I hated people. I did not want people to touch me. Nobody ever touched me unless they wanted something. I trusted no one. And my sponsor said I had to collect 8 hugs at every meeting. I said, I don't want it. She said, I don't care. And I remember after a period of time, I told her, I feel good in here now, but I don't feel this way at home. And she said, if you're not taking this program home, you don't have one. You got sick at home. That's where you take recovery. We don't care if you're wonderful in here for an hour, hour and a half. You got sick at home. That's where you take this program. Tonight, you're going to go home, and you're going to hug Keith. So I don't want to do that. And she goes, I don't care. And so I went home and I started saying the serenity prayer, and pretty soon here comes Keith home for his meeting, and I'm going, oh, jeez. And he walks up to me and I put my arm around him and I hugged him. He goes, what's that for? I said, just for the hell of it, they told me to do it. Don't ask me why. And that's the way I started working recovery in our home. Simone and I had tremendous recovery to make. And I had to change my schedule to get up earlier. We shared a bathroom, and I had to get up earlier and get in and out of the bathroom before she got up. And I'd go in, and I'd kiss her goodbye and tell her I was leaving for work. One morning, she called me, and she said, Mama, are you mad at me? And I said, no, why? And she said, because every morning I get up, and I go in to brush my teeth, I look in the mirror, and your lipstick prints on my face, and I know you care. And I thought, this thing's working. This thing's working. One rule we had in our home. You can only live there if you have a program. We didn't care what kind, but you had to have a program to live there. Simone had to go to Alateen. We made her. She hated us for it, and our sponsor said, let her hate you for something positive. She hates you anyway. Said, why would you come here and find answers for yourself and deny your child? And I think it's wonderful, the Alateen program that you have going on here this weekend. And in our home group today, we have preteen, pre-Alateen, and Alateen in our home group. These kids multiply like crazy. And we have family recovery in our meeting hall. And I love it. Because you see, that's the way we were raised in this program. And I was taken through the steps. I had to do the amends. My amends to my daughter and my husband is to keep working on the Al-Anon program. I have to keep working on turning it over every day. I have to do my meditation every day. And more than anything, I got to pass this thing on in order to keep it. And I love that. Simone and I got involved in service, and then later on, Keith came into service. We were going to convention planning meetings and conventions like this, and I was on the Al-Anon committee, and Simone was on the Alateen committee, and I was always told to invite Keith to go with us. He'd say, no, I don't want to go over there. All those people have those plastic smiles on, and they're phony, and I don't want to do that. But I'll never forget the day he said, I don't think I have anything better to do today. And he went with us. And the man that was chairman of that conference has passed on now. He died a year later. But he saw Keith in the back of that room, and he had seen him around AA. And he pulled Keith out of the back of the room, and they'd never had this commitment before on that convention or since then, but he asked Keith if he would be the marathon candle chairman, that he needed a candle that would stay lit all weekend. Keith was the best marathon candle chairman you've ever seen in your life. We had candles lit all over the house. He would light them on Friday at noon, and we wouldn't blow them out until noon on Sunday because we had to have the perfect candle. And you know what Simone and I do? Dad, that's a good candle. That is cool. Because we supported and encouraged his sobriety. Never has there been a day since he's been an Alcoholics Anonymous that I have ragged on that man for going to an AA meeting. That's where my husband belongs, is in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've never resented that. And the first time I saw my husband love on an alcoholic, I fell in love with him. Because my husband wasn't a lover. And when I saw him hugging on another alcoholic, I knew there was hope for our family. There have been many alcoholics that he's loved and hugged on since. Alcoholics are always welcome in our home, and so are Al-Anons. In the very beginning, I remember calling this long-timer out in California. Her name was Elsa Chamberlain, and I used to talk to her all the time. And I called her one day, and I said, Elsa, our house is not an Awana club. There are alcoholics in here all the time. I have no privacy anymore at all. And she said, her and Chuck had been in the program 30-some years at that time, and she said, do you want what we got? And I said, yeah, I do. She said, then I suggest you start bringing Al-Anons into that house. And I started doing it. I'm biting Al-Anons over. And our home is a home of recovery. And there's people in and out of it all the time. I used to sponsor this gal that every other weekend she packed her china and moved out and came and stayed at our house. And Keith would say, why don't you just leave your china here? Because he supported Al-Anon recovery. He didn't bring drunks over anymore. But he was welcoming Al-Anons into our home to get away from violent drugs because he knew what they were fighting. You see, you can't keep this thing unless you give it away. That is the greatest gift in this world. You see, I have a purpose today. 18 years ago, I had the privilege of getting to start an Al-Anon panel in a woman's prison. One of the greatest gifts I've ever been given. I was the first Al-Anon that those prison inmates ever invited to their AA banquet. 3 years ago, they voted Keith Man of the Year at their AA banquet. Three of the Manson girls and three other inmates pulled him up at the front of the room, set a chair up there, and sang Mr. Big Stuff to him. Those women in that prison have taught him how to love women. And they love us. They love our family. And Keith has a panel in there. He's had his, on January, I've had my panel 19 years, and Keith will have his 18 years. There's never been a dark night on either one of our panels in that many years. People from our home group go in there with us. And it wasn't fun in the very beginning. But slowly, it took them about 5 years of the consistency for them to soften up. And there are Al-Anons in there. A lot of drugs and a lot of addicts and alcoholics in there, but there are a lot of Al-Anons. This lady told me one night, she said, you know, I'm just like you. I get into that rage and I don't know what I'm doing and I can't stop. And I said, were you drunk or loaded when you did what you did to get in here? She said, no, absolutely not. She said, I had a fight with my drunk husband, and I stood in my living room and watched him put a hole in my 9-year-old daughter's head with a .45. And she said, I picked up that gun and I showed him, and I'm doing a double life term in here because I can't prove I didn't kill them both. A lady a couple months ago said, did you ever kick Keith out? And then when he started to leave, said, where in the heck do you think you're going? I said, oh yeah, many times. She said, well, my husband started to leave, but he wasn't out of range. My 12-gauge shot down, and I'm in here for life. And every time I walk out of there, every time I talk to one of those inmates, I say, but for the grace of God. But for the grace of God. Our daughter got through Allison, made the transition into Al-Anon. Very lovely lady. And a week from this Monday, she comes home for Christmas. She moved to Italy 18 years ago. And she went over there to model because Allison and Al-Anon taught her that she could follow a dream. And she went over there to become an international model, and she did. But if she was here today, she would talk to you about the miracles in Al-Anon and AA over there. Because Al-Anon was only 4 years old. She went over there and had very little literature. And she started a lot of stuff in Al-Anon over there. She got them back into the traditions. The treasurers thought that the seventh tradition was for vacation. And she ended up, after a few years, being the delegate for Italy. She's translated a lot of AA and Al-Anon literature into Italian, so they'll have more literature over there. She started conventions like this. She started a woman's conference. And then 8 years ago, she married an Italian man over there. And we'd met him. She'd brought him home once. And we met him, and we love him a lot. We can't find anything with him wrong with him, except he likes to work a lot and take care of our daughter, and that's just fine with us. And 4.5 years ago, they had a little girl named Nicole and gave us a granddaughter. And what a gift. I got to go over there when that baby was born. And I got to be a mother. And I looked around my daughter's house. Her house did not have holes in it, in the walls. Nobody was crying and screaming and yelling at each other. And I thought maybe, just maybe, because of what her mother's doing and what her grandpa and that little girl's grandparents doing, maybe if we keep doing what we're doing in this program, maybe the chain of alcoholism can be broken. Maybe. And last April we went over there and we went to meetings everywhere. They translated for us and we got to sightsee and stuff, and that little girl is just the light of my life. She doesn't know how we treated her mother. She loves us and she's not afraid of us. He's Pappy and I'm Granny. She named him first. The first time they came home, she said, Simone was trying to get her to say Grandmama and Grandpapa. And she started going to a meeting and put his coat on and he's going to go to a meeting. And she ran down and grabbed him by the leg and she goes, "No, Pappy, no, Pappy." And we all started crying. Oh, my gosh, she named him. And we all cried, and he loved on her. He left, and I told Simone, "Take her in the other room. Let me get my coat." And we tried it, and she just goes, "Ciao, ciao." But before they left, I was Granny. And then I went shopping one day, and she couldn't have everything she wanted, and she threw a tantrum. My grandchild threw a tantrum. And she started stomping and screaming in that store and throwing a wall-eyed fit. And so I just walked out of the store. And she followed me out of there screaming, "Granny, me, 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 me." I thought, whoa, me, me, self-centered. I wonder where she got that. And she'd stand in front of me and jump up and down and stomp and scream and holler, and I'd turn my back on her. And she said, "No, Granny." And I got her in the car and we started heading home and I turned up the music. And I was bebopping, and she goes, "No, Granny! Me, me, me," and she wanted to cry and holler and I wouldn't pay attention to it. And pretty soon she reached over and she goes, "Granny, excuse-o, I love you." And I said, "I love you too, sweetheart." And I got her on the console, and she put her arm around me, and because she had to sit in a seatbelt, you know. But we were going up the hill to our house, and I took her out and set her on the console beside me. And we turned the radio up real loud, and we drove by people, and she was going, "Yeah." You know, she was big stuff. And she is big stuff. Because of you. She is big stuff because of you. We have the life that we have today because we have people like these people in our that came with us in our life today. You know, people say, "Do you and Keith have a lot of time together?" And we go, "Yeah, we have quality time." It's not quantity, it's quality. I would rather have a good 5 minutes with that man than a screwed day. And I don't remember the last time Keith and I had a fight. Because you see, I got to recognize early on that when we had a fight, what I was trying to do was change his mind. And I don't think I have the power to do that. And it's okay for us to not agree with each other today. And when that kind of thing happens, we have fun with it and we laugh about it. We give it the light touch. And we give each other space, and I don't say, "What's wrong with you? Do you love me?" My sponsor told me early on to quit asking questions you don't want the answers to. Because I'd hear, "Not today." And I had to do a lot of changing. There's nothing I love in this world more than my husband's sobriety. You see, I work a program for me. And in doing that, I support his sobriety. Because you see, on any given day, I don't know who's going to be the example of recovery in that house. And some days it's him and some days it's me. But the good news is that God's never let any of us be in a bad place at the same time. There's always been one person in our home that's a good example because of you. God uses people to help other people. And if you're new and you're in this program, grab a hold. Grab a hold as fast and as hard as you can because you can make it with it. But without it, you'll grow apart. We have to be walking down this same railroad of life in the same direction or we'll grow apart. And Keith and I are such lovers today. He's my lover today. And we have a lot of fun. I don't hate that man anymore. I haven't hated him since I did a fifth step. Because you see, I got to take responsibility for my actions. The steps work. The support of a home group works. Service works. And what it does for a family is bring it back together. If our family can make it, I know your family can make it because God uses people to help other people. And I want to close with a story of only how I know to explain my God. And so this little boy was laying in the bedroom one night and it was thundering and lightning outside and he got scared and he ran and got in bed with his dad and he was shivering and shaking. And his dad cuddled him up and he goes, "Son, what's wrong?" And he said, "I was in there by myself and I got scared. It's thundering and lightning outside and I was scared, Daddy. I was alone." And his daddy cuddled him up and he said, "Son, you weren't alone in there. You did not have to be afraid. God was in there with you." And the little boy looked up at his daddy and he said, "Daddy, yeah, I know. But," he said, "right now I need something with skin on it." And that's what you are to me. You are my God with skin on it. Thank you for always being there.